Welcome back. I'm Adrian Wojnarowski, host of the Vertical Podcast with Woj, powered by Digital Media. And I have been excited about this particular show, anticipating it now for a few months. Actor Jerry Ferrara is in studio. You know him more recently for his role on the Starz Network show Power, where he plays Joe Proctor. But you know him best for his seven seasons on Entourage, where he played Turtle on the show and then in the motion picture. And a character in Turtle who was much like, and maybe the only real way, like Jerry, was his love of basketball, his love of the Knicks. Not many other similarities between the real-life Jerry and the fictional Turtle. But we talk a lot about Entourage, the intersection of basketball, the NBA, the Knicks, the Lakers, from Lamar Odom to Jerry Buss to Kevin Love, who appeared on the show in cameos. And, of course, Jerry, who is a lifelong Knicks fan, grew up in Brooklyn, played a little ball on Staten Island in college, and now is a regular on the fantasy basketball camp circuit, where he at one point stalked Jeff Van Gundy at a Vegas camp to get him to draft him for his team. We'll dig into that. He did play for John Calipari the year before. A lot to cover with Jerry. One thing, though, in our conversation on the Knicks, we taped this show prior to the whole Derrick Rose saga, so we do not cover that with Jerry. I think we will maybe at a later time, but I think you'll enjoy listening to this one as much as I enjoyed sitting down with Jerry on it. So here we go. Here in our New York studio with actor, Knicks fan, and fantasy basketball camp regular.
Star.
Jerry Ferrara. Jerry, hey man, thanks for stopping in. Thanks for doing this.
First of all, my pleasure. And before we get started, I just want to say something. There was a moment where my now fiance, but back then she was my girlfriend, was suspicious that I was maybe stepping out on her or something, because I was obsessively on my phone, like stalking someone. And she's like, "Who are you creeping on? What's going on?" I'm like, no, you don't understand. Woj is breaking stories, right? I was like, this is not what you think it is. It's all fine. It's sports relations. Like, oh, okay. You could stalk his Twitter, but no one else's. Yeah. So you almost got me in trouble, buddy.
Well, I appreciate it. And Jerry, you're in New York filming, Power here for a couple months. It's headed for its fourth season. So it's a chance to see your Knicks in what was going to be a playoff year. Like Kristaps Porzingis is becoming a star. Derrick Rose was going to recreate himself here in New York.
Super team.
How's that?
Right?
How's that going?
Called the super team early on. They're really only talking about us and the Warriors, I believe was the quote.
How's that going?
It was going really well in the beginning. I went to the home opener against Memphis, which they won, and you know, Noah looked great and energized the team. The Garden was loud and electric. And it continued for a while, and we even put up a good fight on the first West Coast road trip, but it, I think it's six in a row. I mean, we're taping this on the day after Giannis just hit the game winning walk off shot. Mm-hmm. So, I've hit the panic button, but, it's something I'm not unfamiliar with. I've hit this button many times before for the Knicks, and, you're the best person to talk to, because now is it a let's just rip it down and get a good draft pick? I'm not going to say the word tank. I don't believe in that. But or should we still swing at the 7-8 seed? Because this thing is going down fast right now. I'm terrified.
Well, the idea was certainly to make the playoffs, and
yeah,
they have enough star pieces. But the one thing this stretch has showed is they can't win without Porzingis.
Right.
Like they, you know, this stretch of games without him, you know, they had the Bucks game, and we can talk about those last. I've never seen a guy bounce the ball 10 times backing his way down and not see help come on a guy everybody knows Milwaukee wants to take the shot. But this was a big year, I thought, for Porzingis for his next step, and he has shown that early. He's been tremendous, and he's as good as, you know, if you were starting teams over in the NBA, if you did a draft and made everybody available in the league and said, okay, this is for the next 10 years, not
right
for trying to win this year with Steph Curry or
Durant. It's almost like a 28 and under draft.
Right. Karl-Anthony Towns, Giannis, and Porzingis, how do you draft them?
Like, who? What order?
Because Giannis is in that conversation now.
I think he, and especially after watching every single second of that game last night, including the steal, even though it wasn't a steal, he knocked it, he fouled Rose, mm-hmm. but he knocked the ball off his hip out of bounds. He might be number one. I hate to say it, but being a bit of a homer, I would say Porzingis is number one. If you're talking about the next 10 years, 10 to 12 years, whatever. But man, watching Giannis do what he did last night, I would still pick Porzingis one because again, I've grown to love him, but man, that, I can't believe he's averaging two blocks and two steals a game. Mm-hmm. That's what's most impressive about Greek Freak is that element, which I think is getting ignored a little bit from all the other wonderful things he does on the court, like dunking from the 3-point line. It's the two blocks and two steals effortlessly.
Now, when you go to Knicks games, though, Jerry, are you automatic? I make the call. I'm on Celebrity Row. That, like, every time you're there now.
Yes.
Or do you have to be judicious in how you ask? Like how often can you ask?
Okay, because that is a thing. It is a yes for the most part, but I never, because to me the biggest gift outside of obvious things that my career has afforded me, like changed my family and I's life, you know, for many different reasons, but the sort of fringe benefit being such a big sports fan, such a big basketball fan, and a diehard Knicks fan was I get those great seats. And so, but I don't ever look at that like it's something that should be given to me. I still feel like a kid who snuck into a party who's going to get thrown out at any second. So I always ask very kindly. I always say, I get it if you guys are full. Just, I ask like 7 days in advance. I plan my schedule around Knick games. So, judicious was a perfect word because it's not like I want to come to the game tonight. I'll be there at 7. No, I don't handle that. And I also tell everyone affiliated with the Knicks or Madison Square Garden, if you guys need me for any whatever press thing, you want to do a Madison Square Garden top 10, whatever you need from me, you say the words. I am not above pimping myself out for those seats. You want me to name my first child Nick? We could even do that. So, yeah, I've done a lot of stuff for the Garden over the years too, but they have been very, very kind to me over the years. I think it's the reason why I continue to want to act and work is to get those Knicks seats.
Yeah, it's a reasonable motivation. Scorsese was on the Entourage set toward the end of the show, right?
Yes.
Now,
yeah,
for every like actor, meeting him as an actor is like you're meeting, especially a young actor from, grew up in New York.
Italian-American from Brooklyn. Yeah. I mean, he's one of our icons.
So, truth be told, what was a bigger moment for you? Meeting Scorsese when he comes in, or you get a command performance, a command get over here from Kristaps Porzingis?
I'm going to say it's the Porzingis thing. Wow. And the reason is, I don't know if Scorsese is going to remember meeting me. This is plain and simple. There is a 50-50 chance that he might, and I'm not saying it because of his age or anything. He's got a lot of things going on. I know Porzingis remembers that because he's still only in his second year. So I'm going to go with that. Like, I got in on the ground up with Porzingis.
When Kristaps.
Ground floor.
When everybody in New York, you know, when Knicks fans were pretty negative toward the drafting of him, to put it mildly.
Right.
You were the voice of reason in the Twitter woods.
Well, I certainly had initial thoughts that were like, wait a second, and I'm a Knicks fan, so I'm scarred from the Frederick, I don't know if I'm saying his first name correctly,
Weiss,
and Maciek Lampe. Mm-hmm. Am I saying that name? Probably butchering that name as well, but I definitely have the scars of that, but I try to be realistic and not judge people. A lot of people said similar things with Dirk. They didn't know what Dirk was going to be, so all I said on Twitter, which we all know is very important, I just said, look, I'm reserving judgment. I don't know anything about him. So I want to wait and see what happens. And then I actually went, and maybe we'll discuss, because I was at this USA fantasy basketball camp, which is in Vegas.
Yeah.
And it timed out with Summer League. So I stopped by a Knicks Summer League game, and I saw a young guy, who was playing defense in the Summer League. And you don't really always see big men running up and down. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, to me, Summer League is always more of a guard-oriented thing. Guys who could create their own shot and could put up points and stand out. But to see a big guy operate in the post a little bit and run up and down and play defense, I then publicly said, I think he's going to be great. I don't know if he's going to be a Hall of Famer, but I think he's going to be a viable commodity for the New York Knicks. That was my stance early.
Now, I think his older brother, Giannis, was a big Honoraj fan. Again, Kristaps' generation was, he's 21 now?
I think he's 20, 21.
They didn't necessarily grow up with it, but his brother did. And
yeah, he was like seven when Entourage started, which just makes me feel old.
Yeah, that was when he had the cornrows. That was when Kristaps had the...
I knew I liked him right from that moment.
But he reached out to you through maybe the Knicks. Hey, we come over.
Yeah, I was here at the beginning of the season last year, of the basketball season, and I think he was about 10 or 15 games in at this point, so he's already taken the city by storm, and next thing you know, everybody loves him, and oh, they did it, poor Zingod, and all this stuff that they got the little kid who was crying on draft day to take a picture, so he was already showing like he had a sense of humor about negativity that was thrown at him, but he did a radio show here in New York, and I was at work. I was shooting season three of Power, and my phone just started exploding with texts and tweets, and I didn't really have a chance to look at it, but finally I did, and the gist of it was Porzingis was on this radio show, and they asked him, if you could look over into Celebrity Row, who would you be most excited to see? And why this future Hall of Famer, I'm going to say, in my opinion, said, well, you know, if it could be anybody, I'd be really excited to see Jerry Ferrara. And what, do you love Entourage? I think he said, well, my older brother loved Entourage, but they, you know, basically what he said was he didn't bury me when I got drafted and he stayed optimistic. So he sort of gave me props for that. And then the whole thing happened really fast from there. I was going to go to the game that night. They're like, oh, Kristaps wants to meet you. I got to the game. I was ushered to half court. And I just got to shake his hand. It just was like a bromance in full. I want to say even someone posted like a slow-mo video of us hugging. It was a budding bromance from the beginning.
And the thing I think, too, now for Knicks fans, there hasn't been – it's always been guys who maybe weren't quite the stars everyone wanted to believe they were. There was always a savior coming in New York. It was Stephon Marbury.
Right.
It was Carmelo Anthony coming when they didn't get – LeBron or the big three. There hasn't been really since Patrick Ewing, which was a true, but Patrick was, you won the lottery and everybody knew who Patrick was. Everybody had watched him play 4 years of college. You knew what you were getting. With Porzingis, it was, you didn't, but once he shows up, for Knicks fans, the history of first round picks is awful. It's just awful. Very few have even become starters, rotation players. But there was a feeling around the garden last year and this year like, hey, he's ours. This is our guy. And that hasn't been there in 20 years.
You're absolutely right. It has not been there since Patrick. I can go down the list of those draft picks if you'd like. And we don't have to waste your audience's time doing that. I think everybody knows. Some players turned out well, but no, there has not been a bona fide young, not even entering his prime yet, still in the early developmental stages of stardom, since Patrick Ewing. So there is a level of optimism that is citywide for the Knicks. But that being said, it's still New York, and patience is not necessarily a virtue over here. So we still want to win now. We still want to be in the playoffs. So I think it's a interesting push and pull. That's why I'm watching, because I want them to win, but I'm also watching him and that team because there are expectations to at least get into the playoffs now, but he's still 21 years old. He hasn't even begun to scratch the surface of what he could be, but it still is exciting times, even if this season doesn't end up the way we all would hope. But I would like to see him in the playoffs. I think that could be valuable experience, even if it's the 8th seed and they get bounced out in 4, which would probably happen. I think the experience getting a guy like Porzingis playoff experience at 21 years old is very, very valuable.
No, there's no question. It has value. And for a team that just hasn't been in the playoffs over the last 15, they just haven't been in very often. So it does matter just to get in and feel it and feel what it's like on the stage and sort of see, you know, Detroit. I remember talking to the Detroit guys last year and, you know, they got drilled by the Cavs. But for a young team, it was great for them to get on the stage to see, okay, this is the intensity of it. This is how far we've got to go, and no, there's no question. You mentioned fantasy basketball camp. Now, Jeff Van Gundy, who, of all the coaches there last summer, Tom Izzo,
Brad Stevens. Who else was there? Jeff Van Gundy, who I looked at early.
But explain to people how it works. You go to
Mike
fantasy
Patello.
Camp.
I mean, there's just so many great right. PJ Carlissimos.
It's generally like, for the most part, rich white guys who go to – there's a circuit of them. They go, there's guys who go – they go to Dukes. They go to Miami's. They go to – there's a circuit.
The Duke one is apparently
– pretty extravagant.
Pretty extravagant. Yeah. But yeah, it's pretty expensive, and I'm not going to lie. I did not pay for it. So I'm just saying I was invited as a guest. They solicited me. I didn't solicit them. But basically – and I didn't even realize, like, well, I wonder why I didn't get invited to this before. It's like, oh, you have to be 35. So, like, on my 35th birthday, I got invited to this for the first time. And you basically – and I had always heard about it. And at the time, I was playing basketball 3 or 4 times a week. I still play 3 or 4 times a week. I love playing. And the way it was pitched to me was just this unbelievable experience where you get to play and you get treated like you're actually a real athlete, which is totally false. And then you get this great access to USA basketball, which is totally true. Mm-hmm. You do. And you're walking around the casinos in Vegas and you can sit down, you play blackjack. You never know who's going to walk up to the table, especially in that first year, which was 2 years ago, which wasn't an Olympic year. It was a much more loose environment. This past one was they were preparing. But what happens is you play in a scrimmage game, and I made the rookie mistake where they say don't give it all up in the scrimmage, because then the coaches are watching and they evaluate you. And then they go in a room and they draft you. So I'll skip to the second season because I made the decision I wanted to be on Van Gundy's team. I think in the 10-minute scrimmage game, I think I had 13 points. I was 3 for 3 from downtown. Not great from the free throw line. I literally looked at Van Gundy.
Is there any way to verify any of these numbers?
There's stats.
Yeah.
We can go right on the website.
Okay.
Well, I do not lie. I do not lie about this stuff. And I told Van Gundy, I like pointed at him after I hit a 3, and I'm like, you better take me in the first round. I was being like, my alter ego came out. And we could talk about how it went down, but I did not end up on his team.
So he passed on you.
Yes, he did.
And so
Coach Cooley from Providence ended up drafting me. Smart guy.
So in advance of our visit today, I texted Van Gundy last night. Now, I didn't realize it was a game night for him. He was at he did the Blazers Warriors game.
Yes, he did.
And then I turned it on and I heard his voice and I said, oh, I guess I'll. But I think it must have returned it during a timeout.
God,
which he's
it.
Known as. He'll text through during it. Like he's.
Oh, I love that.
So I did get his response to him having passed on you in fantasy.
Am I going to want to hear this? Am I going to want to hear this?
Listen, Jeff's going to speak. He's a man of coaching truths, right?
I could take it.
Right? And I'm going to quote Coach Van Gundy here. I missed on him. Underestimated his love and competitive streak. Too concerned with size and unfortunately overlooked his love of the game. Focused too much on his weaknesses and not enough on his strengths. I messed up.
Can I have – could I – I'm going to print that on towels and napkins. That's going to be
plastered
all over my house.
Jeff Van Gundy, I messed up. Jeff Van Gundy and Jerry Ferrara, I messed up.
Can we lead off a report on the vertical with that? That would be a great story to lead off the day with. And I will say something about Coach Van Gundy. We actually had a lead on his team. My team ended up going 0-4. We were not very talented. But – we had a lead. We blew 3 leads in those 4 games. And we had a lead on them, which we kind of wasted away. There was a technical foul that happened late in the game. So they had a 1-point lead. And they're inbounding the ball under their hoop. And we had to obviously go for the steal. If we didn't get the steal, we had a foul right away. Pretty simple stuff. So I'm guarding my guy, who's their sort of number one guard. And they ran like a back pick on me under their own hoop. And he ran up basically a fly pattern down, and they just threw a long pass right over my head. Guy caught it by himself and in the last 8 seconds of the clock burned up. So he ran a great play. I mean, he even said, I knew it was going to work. He was clapping his hands. I knew it. And he ran it on me, which was – I took that as a big offense. So – but he missed on me, and I'm going to hold him to that for the rest of his life.
People think fantasy camp, and they think screwing around, laughing. Guys are maniacs at this thing.
Oh, no, it's
lots
not real.
There's injuries, right? The trainer is the – like, guys, of course, no one's in the shape they need to be in to be playing hard.
No.
Like, I've retired to now. I will play my son in 21. I will play him in horse. But, like, I can't afford to get what I know is coming, torn Achilles, tendons.
I'm right in that age bracket,
right,
too.
I can't be on crutches going around trying to get on planes, so – again, it's 21
and that's
course.
It. Yeah. Someone, the first day I was there, broke their arm. There was an Achilles pop, which I heard, which is still, this me, this is the scariest thing. They stress that. PJ Coliseum gives a great opening ceremony speech where he basically roasts all the coaches that are there and us. He tells us how terrible we are and awful at everything in life. But then they really get serious about the injury part of it because everyone is 35 and up, not in the greatest of shape. And after the first day, you play like three games in one day. So that night, I went to go play a little blackjack, and I actually had a drink, and I'm trying to blow off some steam. And buddy Zeus was at the table. This is my first encounter with a gentleman named Zeus, who's a very, very strong, strong gentleman. And we're playing blackjack, and I got a – I don't even know what it was. It was a right hamstring groin cramp where my leg locked up. And I'm at the blackjack table at 10 o'clock and I'm just going, ah! Oh, my God. What it? And Zeus had to help me unlock my hamstring. That was my introduction to 35 years old.
Zeus was a – we have a common friend, Chris Caputo, who's associate head coach at University of Miami. And Chris is the master of these fantasy camps. He works Dwayne Wade's.
I want to go to the Miami
the University
one,
of Miami one. Like, he'll be a head coach someday, and he gets to know all the rich guys at these things. And so he'll be at a mid-major as head coach, and they're going to have the biggest recruiting budget. They'll have private planes because they'll have all these guys donating to his program. So, but I met Zeus, who played football at Florida State for Bobby Bowden, and he is, maybe 6'5"?
Yeah.
6'4"?
Built like there. He's 240. I'm probably underselling, but he's just he's a monster. He's huge.
Yeah. And so it's like these are the guys you're playing with.
Yeah. I think Kyrie Irving's dad played.
Diedrich, yeah. He was a good player.
2 years ago.
Played for Rick Pitino at BU.
Everyone, look, there's certainly one or two people on every team that have almost no basketball experience. But for the most part, every team has competent players. The first year I played, I got drafted by John Calipari. So I got to play for Coach Cal, who benched me in a playoff game, and I still don't let him – I'm still mad at him for it. But we had like a really good – there's guys dunking and guys who played college ball. So it's just everyone's hanging on, I guess, to the glory years of what used to be. But, yeah, these guys take it very, very serious.
This is the Vertical Podcast with Woj.
If you're enjoying this program, then check out the MMQB podcast with Peter King.
What's the one thing that you take away from Bill Belichick and you say, this is the thing that everybody else is missing?
Everything is about supplying information to Bill so he can make the decisions. And Bill has the front office and the coaching staff all on the same page. That's the biggest difference. And there's never a day off with Bill Belichick.
Listen and subscribe to new episodes every Wednesday of the MMQB podcast with Peter King.
And now a word from Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage approval process into the 21st century, fast, powerful, and completely online. Rocket Mortgage has taken all the complicated, time-consuming parts of applying for a mortgage out of the equation. Hate searching through stacks of old files and paperwork? With Rocket Mortgage, you can easily share your bank statements and pay stubs at the touch of a button, helping you to get approved in minutes for a custom mortgage solution that's been tailored for your unique financial situation. Even better, with Rocket Mortgage, you can do all of this on your phone or tablet. It's a quick online process that you can manage from the convenience of your couch. So if you're looking to refinance your mortgage or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/Woj. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. Jerry, your role on Entourage is Turtle. As much as any show of its era, was so intertwined with the NBA. Mm. And it was sort of at a time when the NBA was, you know, the popularity of stars, it was – football is like sort of the ultimate team game and everybody's behind helmets. And, you know, baseball's funny with young people. Like, there's guys making I grew up knowing every baseball player.
Same.
I'm sure you did too.
Same.
And I'll see guys getting $100 million deals and I'm like, I don't know who that guy is. Now, some of that goes on in basketball free agency now. People go, hey, who's that guy? He averaged 5 points a game. He just got $50 million. I get that too. But you guys came along at a time when, you know, NBA players, the celebrity of players was really growing. And the cameos you guys had on your show were, you know, of course, being around the Lakers. But the one that always stood out to me was Lamar Odom. And it was the Johnny Drama Cavs Not C-A-V-S.
Right, not Cleveland Cavs.
Right,
calf.
Yeah. Calf, right?
Like the muscle. The
when you saw, first of all, when you saw that script of we're going to do a show around Johnny Drama wants bigger calves, and then we're going to sort of bring in Lamar Odom to like further that conversation, was it believable to you?
Well, first and foremost, like from the very beginning, our creator, showrunner, Doug Allen, like we've had a great relationship. Him and I are really, really good friends. And I remember, so I could say this to him, like that was in season two. I remember saying, because there wasn't just that episode, that storyline stretched out over the rest of the season. I remember saying, so Johnny Drama's season two arc is he wants calf implants? Like that's what you're going to roll
calf
with?
Implants.
This is HBO, man. Like you want to roll with that? He's like, it's funny, I'm telling you. And sure enough, it's like only someone like Kevin Dillon could kind of take that and make it so believable. Like I'm sure he had a few guys going, oh, I wonder how, maybe I should get calf implants. And all based on the fact that Lamar Odom's calves are good. Like he's a professional athlete. So we shot at that Laker game that night. And it was the one game I think that Kobe wasn't playing and he was injured. And right after we went into that Champions Lounge at Staples Center, and that's where we were going to shoot the stuff with Odom, and we had a couple other cameos. And sure enough, right after the game, Odom came right up. We were all ready for him, came right in and did that. I don't even know how much he knew. It was a lot of improv, I guess, for that scene. But Kevin Dillon says to him, Lamar, what do you do for your calves? And Odom even looked at us like, well, this guy's a freak, man. What do I do for my calves? And walked away. And Kevin Dillon must have had people for years coming up to him wanting to see his calves.
That was a second season.
Yeah, I believe so.
Did you have to explain to anybody after the first year, like in LA, in Hollywood, around an athlete like that? Was everyone bought into the show yet? Did you have to explain what it was to anybody at that point?
Yes. It did not get out of the gates like strong. And luckily, HBO at that time, and still is, was the place where, you know, they weren't driven by ratings. It's a subscription-oriented business. So our numbers weren't great, but they didn't really necessarily care. The president at the time, Chris Albrecht, loved the show and thought it had potential. So if we were on a network or a different cable channel, we might have been canceled early on because the numbers weren't great. But it started to slowly build. Early on, it was impossible to get cameos because people really, actors, athletes, they didn't know if like the joke was on them or not.
Right.
And it never was. Like it was always inclusive. Like this is what we want to do. And if you think this is funny, give us your input. I say us. I mean, really Doug Allen and everybody else. I wasn't really a part of that part of the process in the beginning, but, it was impossible. We leaned heavily on Wahlberg to get a lot of early cameos, but by the end, there was like a list that we didn't even, there's a lot of people who I think were promised cameos on the show. And I think they might've all been in the movie at some point because there's so many cameos in the movie, but it was impossible to get people to do the show early on. But
that scene, you had those courtside seats right next to the Laker bench where you're filming.
Yeah.
And that was when Ari had the was yelling at the fan behind him. I'll shoot a hook shot if I
I'll
want from here.
I'll shoot a three if
I want to. Right? Are you so like when you're filming there and it's during the game and like I think you had to respond to sort of what was going on in the court.
Yeah.
Is that an awkward place to act and to be shooting?
No, not for me. Okay. And I always remember always trying to give whatever dialogue I had away for those scenes. We'd go up to Dylan, take these lines. Just set, cause I just wanted to enjoy the game. I didn't want to have to be responsible for cues and beats or anything like that. So I was always looking to get, you think this line's funny? Take it. It's yours. My gift to you. So, the hardest part was for me loving basketball so much was not getting distracted in the game and actually keeping up with the cues and the beats of the scene. But, no, for me, that's another, besides the cameos, the other great parts of the show were getting to shoot at Laker games. We got to shoot at the Cannes Film Festival, at the Sundance Film Festival, at the U2 concert, at Yankee Stadium. You know, we've got that stuff. We were always at the real places. That's what always made the show unique for me as an actor. It always felt like you were doing like a big movie, a mini movie each week.
There was a scene that got cut out of that Laker game appearance.
Mm-hmm.
You and Dr. Buss, Jerry Buss, the owner.
I remember right after the Odom scene, you know, Dr. Buss was in there because that's just where he was. And I think one of our ADs or someone went up to him and said, hey, you want to do a little improv or something? And I think he said, yeah. And I think it was Doug who looked at me, was like, just go up to him and try and get him to trade Kobe to the Knicks. I'm like, okay, that's fun improv. I like that. So I walked over to him and the scene starts, and I think I made it like a joke. I was like, Howard Eisley, Eddie Curry, and Shannon Anderson for Kobe. Hopefully he was going to like laugh and maybe say something insulting to me, but he said, wait a second, sit down, and just started breaking down why that trade would not work. Credit to him, because he just did not even want to go for the joke. He went for the real business element of it. It ended up not making the show because I think it was a little long, but and I forgot about that until we were speaking a little bit earlier. Yeah, there's a scene. I should try and see if we could find that scene with Dr. Buss.
And Kobe never made the show.
Never made the show, no. The two sort of Kobe stories I had was one before one of the Laker games. I think he was injured and he wasn't playing, but mm-hmm. We got there at like 4 o'clock for rehearsal, and he was just out there. I think he was in street clothes, or maybe he was in some kind of warm-up gear, and he's just kind of shooting around by himself. And then he sort of came over to us, and I think it was how many half-court lefty shots can he make? It was either like 3 in a row or 5 in a row. And I think we ended up betting a little bit. Nothing like real, but sure enough, whatever the number was, if it was 5, he was making 4 in a row. And if it was 3, he was making 2 in a row. Like, he was right there. You would think, how many lefty half-court shots could someone make in a row? I would take that bet every time. He was very close to winning all of those things. And then years later, I had another – he didn't make the show, but I was at a game not shooting, and him and Serge Ibaka ran me and my agent over. For a loose ball, we were in courtside seats, and they just ripped the chairs out from the floor diving for a loose ball. It was the Harden game when Artest elbowed Harden in the head and knocked him out.
Right.
That game.
It was an accident.
It was an accident, but yeah, I just was, they had to peel Kobe off me. We were intertwined with chairs and all this crazy stuff. I wish he would have been on the show, because I got a front row seat to a lot of Kobe games.
At that point, I would imagine when you were sitting courtside at the Laker game, you probably – had you ever been that close? Could you get tickets like that yet in the league? Especially at the Staples. Those are tough.
At that point when we were shooting?
When you were shooting your second season.
No, that was my first time ever on a floor seat. I mean –
Where did you start going – how would you get tickets to Knicks games as a kid? How would you get in?
Honestly, whatever money I had, or like I would always ask for like my birthday gift to be Knicks games, and we sat nosebleeds. I mean, I was at one of the it was the year the Knicks lost in the finals to the Rockets, but it was a regular season game against the Rockets. They both had the best record in the league. I mean, I think we, as high as you could possibly be in the Garden is where we were sitting, and it was the greatest time in the world. I didn't care, and that's why, like, I look at where I sometimes occasionally get to sit, and it will never get old. It's the great, I can't think of anything I want to do. Like, that's the greatest thing. If I won the lottery and won Powerball or something, the first thing I would do is I would buy courtside season tickets to several teams and just go to a different one every night. It's the greatest experience on earth.
You could be a sports writer.
Or that, or maybe I could get an internship in an organization and rise through the ranks and maybe one day make it to GM or team president, something like that. Maybe I know someone who could help me get an internship at an organization. I don't know. I need like a connected guy in the NBA. Where am I going to find that guy?
You're ready to walk away from tomorrow? A team said, hey, listen, we'll wait until your contractual obligations are ended as an actor.
They're almost over. I think they're almost over for Power.
All right.
Yeah,
for negotiating purposes. Okay, there's an end in sight here.
Okay.
If somebody said, okay, come on in, start as a summer intern, let's see where it goes. Now you're getting married. Now there's more to think about than just you.
No children yet, though.
Okay.
Maybe wait on that for a few years. I don't know. Here's a question. Can I narrow it down to like 5 organizations, or is it like any? Because maybe
you narrow it to 5? I mean, I don't know if you're in a position to be that.
I'm not. Okay, so let's say any organization, like it could be at Philly, anyone. I think I would do it.
Okay.
I think I would do it. But is there a minimum? Like I have to be there for like 1 summer, we're saying?
Yeah, we'll give you
I would do it.
And then somebody, all right, and then they say, hey, listen, Joe, we'd like you to stay. We're going to pay a $15,000 to be work in our scouting department, and you're just going to help with video, you're going to help with scheduling, you're going to help with, you're going to do stuff around the facility. This is entry level.
I would take it, but then I would make the point of having one conversation and said, look, I love being here. and I'm absolutely going to accept this, but please just keep me in mind for future climbing the ladder. Like, I'm in this for the long term too. I'm not just doing this for a get. Like, I want to be seriously considered for a promotion in the relative near future. And I will show you with my effort in the AV room.
Okay. Well, I think there's, you know.
Make some calls, Woj. Come on, buddy. Let's do it.
You're doing it right now.
I am doing it right now. This is my interview. Right? Hey, this is my first interview into the NBA.
This is it. On the show, like, the Turtle character initially, like, he'd wear those Nick throwbacks. Bernard King initially.
Oh, yeah.
Patrick.
Yeah.
Was that just your idea initially with the character, or Doug, because it, like, became, and would you decide which ones you would wear? I want to wear Bernard. I want to wear Patrick. There was no one telling you. You probably had autonomy on that, right?
Yes and no, because Doug Ellen's a pretty big sports fan, and luckily my Knicks and Yankees love just coincided with his. He's a big Knicks fan. He's a big Yankee fan. Like, he's a big Islander fan. So luckily I never really had to get into Rangers Islander stuff with him. But so that was a plus for me. But I, at the time, like, even when we shot the pilot, I actually had a jersey collection. I just loved collecting jerseys. So, we talked. Bernard King was a very premeditated, talked about thing. Like, we wanted to make sure it's like, we're not going to wear like just like a Starks jersey, which, I didn't have a ton. Doug would absolutely weigh in if he was like, no, you're not wearing the Steve Francis jersey. He would weigh in on that. He weighed in on everything. And, but luckily he knew that he could trust me. I would keep the jerseys in the right place. There's a lot of good ones. The one that actually gets the most love, I wore like a Kevin Garnett McDonald's All-American jersey that I still have, that people I remember were always bringing up that particular jersey.
Bob Hurley, I did a book with Bob Hurley Sr., The Miracle of St. Anthony.
Mm-hmm.
And the story wasn't in the book, but I remember talking to Bob about this. He was the McDonald's All-American coach, I believe, the year that Garnett was in the game.
Oh, is that right?
And Garnett was not – well, people knew him, but he had moved from South Carolina. It's funny. The first time I ever saw KG, I was covering UConn basketball, and they played a game at NC State. And they had – Ray Allen lived in South Carolina, and Kevin Garnett was at a high school in South Carolina. I'll never forget this. Ray had signed early with UConn, so he was at the game. He drove down – and he knew Kevin Garnett. They were two high school players, and no one knew who Garnett was. He wasn't a national. He was like a sophomore or junior. And I'll never forget this. Kevin's in the locker room with Ray, and here comes a 6'10 kid in the locker room. I remember one of the UConn assistants, Howie Dickerman, who was there and then went on to be a really good head coach later at Central Connecticut. I remember him seeing Garnett going, who is this?
Right.
Who is this? And I remember him running out of the room and grabbing a UConn media guide and running back in and handing it to KG. And having no idea who he was.
Oh, my gosh.
But Garnett plays for Bob Hurley. He shows up late. He's not there. Maybe he missed a practice, flight or something. And Bob was saying, hey, listen, I don't care who this kid is. I'm not playing him. Like, I'm playing the guys who were at practice.
Right. Old school.
Right. We're not, like, he missed something. Maybe it was travel or whatever. He's like, I keep hearing about this Garnett kid, but whatever. We're playing the guys who are here. So Garnett shows up late, and I guess he literally comes running in the gym, no warm-up, takes off his stuff, puts his sneakers on, runs out on the court. And like immediately, like, pins a shot against the backboard, throws an outlet pass, sprints down the court. Somebody, you know, and then he catches the ball off the backboard and dunks it.
And Bob's like, you know
what? I think we can find
a role. Let's give him some run.
I think there'll be a role for KG.
Let's give him some time. Let's give him some burn.
But that time on the show, like, basketball was intertwined with, you know, Kevin, Steve Nash. Kevin Love had multiple.
A few, yeah. I think Kevin Love, I think maybe inadvertently, if he didn't break, he certainly bruised Kevin Dillon's ribs, because there was a – I got a good memory. I'm proud of myself that I remember. It's like – this is something I haven't thought of in probably 5 years. But there was a – this is like a joke. Like, guy walks into a bar. There was a fight scene with Adrian's character and Eminem, and Kevin Dillon comes to break it up. But part of Eminem's entourage, for lack of a better word, was Jordan Farmar and Kevin Love. So in the breaking up of the fight, Kevin Love grabs Kevin Dillon like a bear hug. And he's, you know, he's obviously a strong guy, a little heavier at that time, and like just squeezed Kevin Dillon. I think he like fractured his rib or something like that. Kevin Dillon next day was like, that Kevin Love, man, he grabbed me in the bear hug and he had like a bruise on his rib. I'm like, yeah, he's like 10, Kevin. You're 5'9". So, Kevin Love a few times. LeBron on the show really was, obviously a great get. But, I think that's what a lot of athletes maybe responded to was the theory of sort of making it big and carving out a great living for yourself and empowering some of the people you grew up with mm-hmm. in your inner circle. Cause it really is all about trust. To me, the real crux of the show, it was always built on the fact of friendship. And these guys are in this crazy Hollywood town fighting the Hollywood system, and they were the only ones they could trust. And I think that's what a lot of young athletes maybe responded to. It wasn't ever like intended to be like MC Hammer's entourage, you know, although we had some of those themes at times. But it really was that these four guys would do anything for each other, regardless of whichever one of them made it big. They were all going to go along on this ride. And I think that's what a lot of the athletes early on responded to. I mean, you look at LeBron and, you know, he obviously, I mean, all the guys that he grew up with, I mean, look at them and the amazing success that they've all built. So I think that's what a lot of guys responded to early on.
You were so young. When you got the role, you were 23.
Three, yeah.
You moved out to Hollywood as a 19, 20-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, what gives you the courage at 19 years old? Like, New York guys are typically like, you grew up in Brooklyn, you went to college in Staten Island. And some guys don't ever leave. They like, I'm sure you've got a lot of friends. They would never imagine leaving. No. Like moving to Jersey would be a,
well,
crossing the bridge would be a big deal.
Yeah. It used to always be the joke. It would be like, they got to go all the way to Jersey. They have to take someone with them. It's like, come on, you got to take a ride with me. I got to go to Jersey. I'm like, it's 13 miles away where you're going. But to us, it was like we were going to Mars. It was a couple of different things. One, yeah, I grew up with a really strong single mother who from a very young age was just telling me you could do anything you want to do as long as you really try. And I actually believed her. Like, she convinced me that whatever I put my mind to, even if I don't get fully to where I am, I could have a version of that. And I just always knew growing up in Brooklyn, and I loved growing up in Brooklyn. It was the greatest place to grow up. And I'm still very close with all the kids I grew up with, and my family's all still there. But I just always had the feeling like there's got to be more than just this. As much as I love this kind of box that we live in, like we don't go past 86th Street and 65th Street and 3rd Avenue and 20th Avenue, I love everything in there, but there's got to be more. I would not allow myself to believe that that was it. Not that I wanted to leave that forever, but I wanted to go see. And I'd always wanted to go away to college. We, you know, and the college I went to in Staten Island did not have dorms because it was a sort of you get in if you could pay to go. Mm-hmm. And I always looked at it like I'll go out to LA, and I already had like meetings with agents that, and I kind of did my homework already and knew who I was going to sign with. And I just said, you know what, if it doesn't work out, this place is always here for me, and my family will always be here for me. And I just was never afraid to fail. I still to this day, I've failed a lot, and I've just never been afraid to fail. I always look at it like it's not, the only failure is if you don't try to do it, then you're sort of afraid. And that's the biggest, I just had to know. I'd be okay with saying, oh, I went to LA for 2 years and it kicked my ass and I went back home. I wouldn't be ashamed of that, but at least I would know that it just wasn't for me. Believe me, I have nightmares every now and then. I wake up and I never left, and I was like at home living in my mom's basement, and that was all. And I dreamed that the whole LA thing was all a dream. I'm still scared one day I'm going to wake up.
The group of actors and actresses that you were with, and sometimes you see it like if you ever watch the Eagles documentary and the band, like it's a sports team.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of Glenn Frey says it at the end, like, hey, it's a team. Everybody needs everyone else to play, but some guys are going to get more shots and some guys are going to. And that was sort of like when Glenn Frey and Don Henley were saying, we're getting back together, but we're going to get paid differently. And you see it on a young team. We've seen it in sports. You know, you talked about growing up playing, you know, your Steph Marbury was your rival.
I went to every one of his high school
games.
And
we saw that happen in Minnesota. He couldn't handle Kevin Garnett's contract and stardom. He was the guy, and he wanted to go to Jersey and be the guy. Well, there is, like, okay. Like, of course you always regretted mm-hmm. doing that. But it seemed like your show and your group was immune because, listen, as success comes, different people at different points might start seeing themselves differently. Did your group have to fight that? Was it ever an issue? Because it always felt like in the end you did things for the greater good of the show versus any one guy running off, and there was no David Caruso, you know, NYPD blue type of moment?
Well, first and foremost, and this is something that you could never account for in TV or in movies, you cannot account for chemistry. You could try to cast it. You could say, oh, we think these two or three or this guy and this girl will have a lot of chemistry. It's sort of an intangible that either happens or it doesn't. I've seen it where like two people don't really get along all that much off camera. Not that they're enemies. They just don't have a connection. But on screen, this amazing stuff happens. And I've seen two best friends off camera who don't really – cannot recreate that. So it's an intangible that – you just can't cast. But from the very beginning, from the moment I remember testing for the show with those guys and what that process is like, where they're bringing you basically there with two or three other guys who are auditioning for the same role as you in this room, and they're bringing you in and out, mixing and matching, sending people home. And I remember after the 2-3 hour day, it was me, Kevin Dillon, and Kevin Connolly in front of HBO. And it was another actor there for Adrian's part, because Adrian was in New York and like submitted a tape for it. And we had it instantly from that day. Like, I think when we read our scene, Kevin Dillon called me E, and I was like, nah, bro, I'm Turtle. And we all just started from that moment. And Mark Wahlberg did something very strategic before we shot the pilot. He took us to Vegas and he said, you guys got to get to know each other real well. We went to go, I think it was Roy Jones Tarver 1, and he flew us on a jet with all his boys. He's like, you guys are going to watch how this goes down. Private jet. I mean, I don't even know what airlines I was flying at that point. Like
JetBlue from Kennedy, right?
Yeah. JetBlue was like brand new at that point. So I just didn't even know how a private plane worked, and I was afraid. I remember, I think I might have even like started hyperventilating on the flight because the plane was small. And we came back from that trip, and I think we were like maybe a week away from shooting the pilot. And we had a bond, and we had the camaraderie. So to answer your question in a long-winded way, ego and stuff like that never really entered the equation. I mean, I never got any nominations or anything like that. And I watched Kevin Dillon get nominated 4 years in a row. Piven won 3 Emmys in a row, and I'm the first person standing up. I mean, that's good for all of us. That's good for the team. Even though it's an individual achievement, I don't care who gets it. Just somebody get it. That's the way I always look at it. That whoever gets it, great. I don't care. As long as I still have a job, I'm good. And I think we all had that kind of blue collar approach. Let's keep our jobs as long as we possibly can.
Right. And because it was a group of guys who, you know, there had been some successes. It's funny. You mentioned you and Kevin Dillon both were on NYPD Blue right before the launch of the show. You were.
Yes.
You were Danny Puglisi. You were a mobster's kid
who ran off.
Yeah. Yeah, I was still watching an audience.
Oh my
it's
God.
On. But you ran
I did a
over
hit and run.
A hit and run.
And I killed someone.
And it got turned back to an old lady in the sewing shop. I think turned you in. She was sewing.
I cannot believe
right?
you. I,
and then
I
Kevin Dillon this. Was the just yeah. like the cop who didn't have his feet under him on the street.
Yeah, we were
right?
in the same episode. I cannot believe you pieced that together. I even forgot about that.
Well, there is this, the IMDb, but I watched it, but I knew it from, and your, now this I didn't remember, you told me before, your father in that scene ended up being.
He played my cousin Ronnie on the show, Louis
right.
Lombardi, great,
Ronnie.
Great
yeah.
actor. He was like on The Sopranos, he played the guy that he was ratting to. He's great. He's been in a ton of stuff. He was even in one of my favorite movies as a kid.
Oh yeah, he was Big Pussy's
yes.
FBI
yes.
guy.
He was like an extra in this movie The Wanderers, which was my favorite book and one of my favorite movies growing up. He, I think, was like a ducky boy, which used to freak us out when we were little kids. So I know Louis for a while. So he played my dad on NYPD Blue. And then years later, because he had a relationship with Doug Allen and Rob Weiss, he played my cousin Ronnie, who got me mixed up with the Sandy Koufax jersey. Right. On the show, Louis Lombardi. Yeah, shout out.
You know, it's funny. I know people, all right, how do I get from being typecast as Turtle? I don't want to be – Turtle was a young – like I can't be an adult Turtle. There's no – like I got type – like it was a young man's part. And I know you sort of took on the mentality of what was like the 16, 17, 18-year-old me. How did he look at the world, right, was how you played Turtle. But now – your body transformed, and it transformed by the end of the show, by the movie. You had lost a lot of weight, you were in shape, and he had become, Turtle become something else. Did that help you break, because the character evolved on the show, do you think that's helped you break away from just being, well, he's just Turtle?
Yes and no. I think the first way, the obvious way you could start to begin to change a perception is obviously physical, because it's what you see. It's easy. It's like the first reaction. Oh, wow, you look different. I didn't know that was you. It helped a little, but it certainly was not like the only thing that started to help that process. I remember there was sort of like a game plan made by my manager, who's one of the producers of Entourage, mm-hmm. Steve Levinson, who's managed Wahlberg forever, and my agent, Brad Slater. You know, it was you, nobody knows you in movies. Like, you're starting over. If anything, you have like two strikes against you, because they only think you're this. And there was a lot of auditions. I never understood this note for the life of me. There was a lot of notes that would come from small roles in movies where, like, oh, the director likes you, but he's worried that you're going to take people out of the movie if they see you pop up. They're going to be like, oh, there's Turtle. Like, okay, I guess on the surface I hear that, and I understand that's a legitimate fear, but so, and I'm not trying to compare myself, but if you've been working for a while, odds are people, any actor's going to show up and people are going to think of what they used to be in,
right?
You know, so that note I never understood, but the plan was, you are going to go do indies, anyone who will have you, you're going to go do these small roles and just start this new chapter. And there was a lot of, the movie that stands out, I did a small part in this movie, Battleship, right? Pete Berg directing, someone I've admired for a long time. He actually was even on Entourage. He did not want to give me this small role in Battleship. I don't know. And he didn't say why. He just was like, he might have even wanted to hire a real Navy SEAL or something, for all I know. That's how Pete rolls. And it was Steve Levinson who talked him into doing it. And he was like, all right, fine, send him down. And sure enough, I was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana for 6 weeks. I think I worked 4 days. But I'm on hold. I can't go anywhere. I'm there. I'm going to LSU games. I'm trying to figure out what to do with myself. But sure enough, I got to know Pete a little bit. We loved the Giants, huge Giant fans. And he saw that I wasn't that. Like, any pre-notions he may have had, he saw that, oh, you were an actor playing a part. I know that. I was an actor. I am an actor. And it sort of led to this friendship, and he cast me in Lone Survivor. And that was a whole other story, because I wanted one of the bigger parts, and he already cast it, and then he wanted me for a smaller part. And I actually said, Pete, I love you, and you've done so much for me, but it's like a day's work. I'm not saying I'm above it, but I want to hold out for more. And he kept rewriting the part and combining different roles. And by the end, it was a good 4 or 5 scenes in a great movie. So I sort of did all that. I did a movie with The Rock that not many people saw, but it introduced me to a financier who put me in movies. So a plan was made, and it helped. But it's such a catch-22. Are we sitting here if there's no Entourage? You know, you and I probably aren't talking, unless maybe my career is a little different and we know each other from something. But what am I supposed to say at 22 years old? No, I'm not going to do the show because I don't want to be typecast. I mean, right. I wanted to work. And fortunately enough for me, in today's day, I think there's so many ways to show the different things you could do. There's so many platforms. There's a lot more opportunity.
You're a podcaster.
I'm a podcaster, and that's just clearly I talk too much, because I feel like I got the clock going. But it still goes on, and the Turtle will live forever, and I'll always get people in the street who will yell that at me. But you know what? It's changed my life and my whole family's life, and I am confident that I could work hard enough to break away. And even when I started to, we did the movie, which put me right, it's like, wow, I'm right back in. But I wouldn't have it any other way.
The show launched at a time, you know, pre-Twitter wasn't, people mm-hmm. weren't living on Twitter. And some of like the, whether it was Ari talking about Lloyd.
Right.
Or Ari talking to women, or any number of things that isolated, if you just took that scene out of the context, you go, hey, you can't say that. And would social media have changed how that show initially maybe was received?
For sure. I think so. I remember actually being on set when there was something in the script saying to the Vince character, something like, you shouldn't have tweeted that. I remember being like, what on earth is that? And someone said, you have 1 million followers. I remember that day where I'm like, what is this Twitter? I remember asking someone, what is this? And it had to be explained to me. I think if you maybe put the show early on season 1-2 on now with everybody having sort of like, let's look for something to, you know, be negative about or spin into a larger story than what it's supposed to be. Yeah, I think we would have gotten buried on certain things and maybe would have benefited in others. But I think it definitely would have had to have been a different show with all the stuff, with everyone basically having a forum to discuss. I mean, I think a lot of people are conscious of it. Yeah, I think it would have been really interesting.
You're in New York until sometime in February. Mm-hmm. Are you mapped out most of the Knick games for the rest of January, February?
Yes. And again, I still will always approach it like, if you will have me, I will love to be there and I will do whatever you say. But yeah,
it's going to be even easier because Celebrity Row is going to start to thin out because it's not going to be like, they're not in the playoff chase. So they're going to be begging you to come.
I'm so upset because I go down with the ship. If we're going down, I'm going to be like the captain on the Titan. I'm going to wait in that room till it all ends. I go down with the ship. I'm not jumping off.
No, Porzingis will get healthy here. He'll be back. And once he's back, it's impossible to fall out of the, first of all, it's impossible to fall out of the Eastern playoff race.
I know, but we lost six games in a row and already we dropped down to like a 10 seed. So, but you could win two in a row.
You win two in a row and you're the seventh seed now, but it'll be.
I think it's going to be okay. Take the Aaron Rodgers approach. Tell everybody to relax. I don't know what that's not going to help at all.
Jerry, listen, man, I appreciate you taking the time to stop in. It was a lot of fun. You did JJ's. You've done mine. We appreciate you at the Vertical Podcast.
So I guess Mannix is up, right?
Oh, he's dying to have you.
Well, I could tell my fiance, this is Adrian. It's not some girl I'm stalking on Twitter. I'm getting my NBA information. This is Adrian. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks, Jer.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Vertical Podcast with Woj. A big thank you to our guest today, actor Jerry Ferrara. Remember to subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes wherever you listen to the podcast. And be sure to subscribe to The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix and The Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick. You can find us on thevertical.com, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play. And you can now hear The Vertical Podcast Network every weekday at 3 Eastern on Sirius XM Satellite Radio on Sirius Channel 214, XM Channel 203, and on the Sirius XM app on Channel 967. We'll catch you next time.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.